Norm Pattiz, let's talk about one of your most famous cases.
So Alex Jones, as many people know, is perhaps the world's best-known conspiracy theorist. Alex had an unusual take on Sandy Hook.
Can you talk about what your defense was right off the bat? Which case do you think had the most impact on your legacy as a defense attorney?
Because I do view criminal defense as a sort of spiritual vocation. No one really is the sum of their worst moments, and we all have the dignity that comes with being God's creatures. And for me, there is no greater privilege than standing next to a despised person and having that person know that I will be there for him whatever happens.
You mentioned that you would have loved to represent Luigi Mangione. Could you have reached out to him and offered your services?
The decision to represent someone is akin to getting married. You're in it for sickness and in health. But nothing that takes place in a criminal courtroom makes the world right again. I don't know how many murder cases I've done, and nobody's ever been brought back to life. One of the worst experiences I ever had in a courtroom was I beat a murder case and I was walking out and I ran into the victim's mother, and it was just the two of us alone for a moment, and I said, I am just so sorry for all that you've lost, and I'm so sorry for all that I may have put you through in this trial. Can I have a hug? And we hugged one another, and I said, you know, I did my job, and I would have done the same for your son had she come to me, and she understood.
Welcome back, everybody, to Misunderstood. I'm your host, Rachel Yucatel. On this show, we challenge assumptions and dive deep into the stories behind the headlines. Today, we have a guest whose name has been attached to some of the most infamous cases of our time. Someone who courts controversy like no other and thrives in the arena of misunderstood justice. Norm Pattiz is one of the country's most provocative and polarizing defense attorneys, known for representing clients like conspiracy theorist Alex Jones in the Sandy Hook defamation trials, and Fotis Doulos in the tragic disappearance and murder of Jennifer Doulos. Pattiz has built a reputation as the man who defends the indefensible. His courtroom prowess and unfiltered commentary have made him a lightning rod for public criticism and legal intrigue alike. But behind the headlines and polarizing cases lies a man with deeply held beliefs about justice, free speech, and the role of defense attorneys in a society that often rushes to judgment. Why does he choose to represent the so-called villains? What drives him to stand by clients the world condemns? In today's episode, we're peeling back the layers of Norm Pattiz, the real man behind the courtroom bravado. His insights may surprise you, challenge you, and even change how you think about the role of law in protecting even the most despised members of society. Stay with us as we get to the heart of one of the legal world's most misunderstood figures. You might just walk away seeing Norm Pattiz in a whole new light. Norm Pattiz, thank you so much for joining me today. How are you?
I'm well. Thanks for having me. I'm flattered.
So you're based in Connecticut, correct?
I am.
So I'm very curious how someone like you from a little sleepy town in Connecticut becomes so famous representing people who are maybe so misunderstood, the damned, the forgotten, people that do not have, that are vilified in the news, so to speak. So I find you fascinating. How did you get on the road to choosing these kind of people to represent?
You know, I think first of all, I want to take exception to New Haven as a small, sleepy town. I mean,
well, if for me.
I like to think that I came by my chops the hard way. I mean, I grew up on the wrong side of the tracks, and people who are misunderstood are the people I grew up around and who I was. And so I think that, you know, there's nothing quite so terrifying as a self-righteous mob. And if someone's hated, I'm drawn to their defense because no one is the sum of their worst moments. And some of the people I've become closest to are probably some of the most vilified people around. I identify with them, I suppose.
I love that answer. So can you give me a little bit of your history of coming up in this world, though? Where did you go to school? What made you go down that specific road? What was your first case? Tell me about that.
Yeah, so my biography probably starts the significant events at age 7 when my father left for work one day and didn't come home. I was an only child. My mother fell to pieces. I was shuffled among relatives for a while. I'm not sure how long. And when she resurfaced, she was changed. And from that moment on, I was fundamentally alone. I turned up to be a reader and, you know, developed a passion for books. I now own a bookstore, for example. The houses that I live in, the offices that I occupy, I have four of them. They're all filled with books, and my office staff despairs when more arrive. You know, haven't you read enough? And I have a thirst to know. So, you know, when it was time, and the Big Brothers program, I think, saved my life. I had a big brother in junior high that would have me out to his house. It was a 4-bedroom colonial. I thought it was a mansion because I'd slept on couches and attics. You know, we lived in rooming houses, my mother and I, for years with very unusual people. So, you know, comes time to get out of high school. I fell, you know, I had a job, a summer job, the best summer job a guy could have. I was a canoe instructor at a girls camp in northern Michigan and a maintenance guy. And, you know, and I'd get away for the summer and like, who's better than me, right? You know, came time to go to college. I had no plans to go, but I knew I needed to graduate high school. I also knew I needed to get out of Detroit, where I grew up. My mother was living with a man who just detested me. And I realized I just needed to get out of there. And somehow I had the sense to know I needed a high school diploma. As luck would have it, I test well on exams. So the assistant principal calls me down one time. We had like 4,000 kids in the school. Says, what are your plans after high school? I said, I just want to get the hell out of town before I kill somebody. And so she got me into college, got me a Mother's Club scholarship. And much to everybody's surprise, maybe not hers, I turned out to be a good student. Years later, I ended up with a fellowship at Columbia for a number of years, taught there for a while, political philosophy, decided I didn't want to be an academic and gravitated toward law school to understand how the world works. Had a divorce, a painful divorce. I'm the only lawyer I know who was paying child support and alimony during law school. But I still graduated with honors, even though I didn't go to class much. And a criminal defense and civil rights lawyer named John Williams took me in out of law school. And it was just magic. He had all these cases that needed to be tried. And for the first 5 years of my career, I could go to trial 2-3 times a month in federal court in civil rights cases. And it was invaluable experience. And I fell in love with the law.
Right. Oh, what an amazing story. So what do you think was the first case that made you stand out, that really set you apart and started giving you a name?
I think the first case that I recall attracting national attention, I ended up on the O'Reilly Factor. I didn't know who Bill O'Reilly was because I don't really watch the news that much. I'm too busy making it. And but it involved a prisoner named Kevin King. I got a call from the public defender's office in New Haven and or in Connecticut. And one of their clients had been beaten up. Would I sue the prison guards? Sure, I said. So I pick up the file and come to find out that Mr. King was placed on trial for his life. We had a death penalty back then. It was a rape murder case. He had raped his girlfriend and beat her so badly she was unrecognizable while she was babysitting her 3-year-old sister. So not exactly a sympathetic set of facts. He tried to escape and the guards beat him up after they caught him. And the escape attempt was very unusual. He was a short guy and he sized up the guards in the facility and realized there was one guard who was about his height and weight. He listened carefully and realized that that guard drove a pickup truck. He knew the make and model. So one night after his conviction, he didn't get death, but he got life. Before they were going to move him to the Supermax, he realized this is my last chance for freedom. He lured the guard into his cell. He had a prison made knife, a shank, said, take off your uniform. When she didn't, he stabbed her in the chest, duct taped her, you know, taped up her mouth, tied her to his bed, put her uniform on, car keys in his pocket, and almost made it out of the prison. He got to the last door when they spotted him. They chased him down a hallway. He fell onto the shank thinking he was going to die, but it missed his heart, and they smacked him around. So I admire his moxie. The crimes are horrible. But, right. You know, even Thomas Hobbes, the great 17th century philosopher and sort of an absolutist, said that when the state seeks to take your life, you can fight back. You contract with the state. You enter into a social contract to protect your life. So I brought the action and got a two. I'll never forget when the verdict came in. He wasn't all that badly injured. He had a fractured eye socket, some bruises. And so we're waiting and the judge is reading the jury form. As to defendant one, 75. I'm thinking, $7,500. That's about right. $75,000. As to defendant two for compensatory damages, $75,000. Or no, I said, congratulations, you made your point. Then the surprising thing happened. As to punitive damages, we, the jury, find yes as to defendant one in the amount of one. And I'm thinking, okay, a buck. They made his point. $1 million. Then the judge did it again. So we're sitting on a $2.15 million judgment for a man from whom we did not hide anything from the jury. I put him up on the stand in his jailhouse orange, his Supermax uniform, and told the jury that these guards behaved like the people they're supposed to protect us from, and that only a jury could protect us from lawlessness. And they did it. So the next day, you know, I was on the O'Reilly Factor, and he's bitching and moaning at me, and I just started screaming back at him, and I think that was 1997 or 98, and so I've never looked back.
Oh my God, that just gave me chills. That's an amazing story.
It's a crazy story, yeah.
Okay, so is there a certain criteria you used when you're picking a client?
Well, I mean, they call me, so you know, like, much though I wanted the fellow who shot the insurance executive in Manhattan to call, it just didn't work out that way. Right. You know, but I look for cases that interest me, that raise significant constitutional issues or philosophic issues that I can explore the contours of the law in. You know, every case is obviously about an allegation that somebody broke the law, but really what a case invites is an examination of what the law is and how it's applied justly and fairly. So I look for hard cases.
And I'm assuming you look for things that you could beat with using the law, as opposed to whether or not the person is innocent or not. Correct?
I don't ever ask that question of innocence, because, you know, sometimes a client will confess to something. I'll say, why'd you do that? And they'll, you know, confession's good for the soul. Well, you know, that the soul is something you take up with God. I'm here to protect your worldly interests, and you're innocent and you're presumed innocent unless proven guilty. And so my job is to defend a person against the allegations. If the state proves them, the state wins. If I can prevent the state from proving them, the state doesn't win. But nothing that takes place in a criminal courtroom makes the world right again. I don't know how many murder cases I've done, and nobody's ever been brought back to life. One of the worst experiences I ever had in a courtroom was, I beat a murder case, and I was walking out of the courtroom into the area before the elevator, and I ran into the victim's mother, and it was just the two of us alone for a moment. And I said, I am just so sorry for all that you've lost, and I'm so sorry for all that I may have put you through in this trial. Can I have a hug? And we hugged one another, and I said, you know, I did my job, and I would have done the same for your son had she come to me. And she understood. Or in another case, a murder case, this one I lost, my client was alleged to have shot someone to death over a girl in the presence of witnesses who knew him for a lifetime. There wasn't much we could do with that, but he didn't want to agree to a plea deal of 40 or 50 years in prison, so we fought the case. At the end, in Connecticut, juries don't know the sentence. They just make a decision, guilty or not. After he was sentenced to 45 years, one of the jurors called me, spitting with rage. Why didn't you tell us what could happen? I said, because the law doesn't permit it. But let me ask you a question. Would you have voted differently if you knew? And she paused for a moment, and she said, no. And I said, welcome to my world. You know, so I find the drama of what goes on in a courtroom the most interesting thing going. And I just can't walk away from it. I love trial.
Right. I mean, I'm curious, listening to you, what your thoughts were. Did you watch the Casey Anthony trial as that unfolded? I mean, I think, as someone who, I love that sort of showmanship in the courtroom as well. And to watch what Jose Baez did at the end there, where he completely switched what happened and what we thought we knew for years following, you know, what this girl was doing and what we thought her defense would be. And then he spun the defense completely different and she ended up getting off. I think we were all stunned. Did you watch that trial?
No, you know, I can never watch another person's trial. It's like watching ice melt. And so I'm aware of it. You know, I mean, our paths, Mr. Baez's path and mine have crossed. I mean, we both interviewed for the Aaron Hernandez case. He got the case. I didn't. I'm told he promised Hernandez a miracle and pulled it off. I wouldn't make that promise, and I didn't get the case. But, you know, I mean, I The OJ case is the one that sticks into my mind so well. I was reasonably confident that he was going to be convicted. And when he wasn't, I was stunned. And I got to know F. Lee Bailey pretty well thereafter for the 10 years or 15 years or so. And we talked at length about the case. He was absolutely persuaded that OJ was innocent or was innocent. And, you know, I think the showmanship of trial is fun. You know, I there's nothing more thrilling than cross-examining someone. It's just it's five-dimensional chess in real time.
Mm. You mentioned that you would have loved to represent Luigi Mangione. Do you have to be called in a circumstance like that? Can you reach out to him? Could you have reached out to him and offered your services?
You know, the rules of professional conduct are difficult, and it might surprise some of your listeners to realize that, yes, lawyers have to obey ethical rules. And one is against solicitation. So I could have written him a letter, but under Connecticut law, I would have had to put in bold type, you know, this is a solicitation, you know, that kind of thing. As a matter of pride, I don't do it. I think of the decision to represent someone is akin to getting married. You're in it for sickness and in health. Or sickness or health, whatever the outcome. And if you don't want me, don't take me. And I'm not going to pursue someone. You know, if I'm their choice and we talk it out and they decide the terms work and I decide I can live with them, then we're going all the way to the end, whether it's happy or unhappy. Right. And I don't want you to have reservations about me. So if I pursue you, you're thinking I'm in it for the money or the fame. And I am. But I'm not going to pursue it to the detriment of your interests.
Well, let me ask you a question about that specific guy. What, I mean, it seems so obvious that he, you know, he in the court of public opinion and all the things that we have learned and seen, we know he did it, but he has pleaded not guilty. What is the uphill battle for his attorney going forward? And if it was your case, what would your defense be?
It would be an implicit nullification case. So the question of jury nullification is a complex one, but it means that a jury has the right not just to decide the facts, what occurred, but whether the law is correctly implied. Almost every jurisdiction in the United States prohibits jury nullification. Very few permit it. I think there are three that permit it. And so the challenge sometimes is to find a case where someone might have public sympathy, at least in some quarters, and get the jury to decide in favor of the defendant, even though he's guilty. Again, I remind you, it's not a moral enterprise that I'm involved in. I'm not about the reformation of souls, but on a semi-religious level, I mean, it's a rare client that I don't read Psalm 23 with, you know, because I do view criminal defense as a sort of spiritual vocation. No one really is the sum of their worst moments. And we all have the dignity that comes of being God's creatures. And for me, there is no greater privilege than standing next to a despised person and having that person know that I will be there for him, whatever happens. And, you know, I related back after 17 years of psychoanalysis, four times a week, 7 o'clock in the morning. I think I related back to my own experience in the Big Brothers program. I had a difficult childhood. It takes a village to raise a child. And I had houses that I could go to on Tuesday night for dinner, Wednesday night for dinner. Sometimes I'd stay out all night just to avoid going home because I was not welcome in my own home. And so I know what it's like to be scorned. But one thing I could count on, if my big brother told me we were going to go to dinner and he said he'd be at a certain street corner at 5 o'clock and I waited for him there, he showed up. And I will always show up for the despised. I have no greater pleasure in life than that, no greater privilege than to be their go-to person. So with respect to this guy and the insurer, some people love him, some people hate him, but he needs somebody that's prepared to fight to the death for him. And what did Jesus once say? Greater love hath no man than this, that you'll lay down your life for a friend. I always tell the young lawyers here, we should demonstrate that level of commitment and you lay down your life for your client.
Do you think that because so many people have made him into somewhat of a hero, that it will be hard for some jurors to actually look at facts and, you know, want him to get off?
Yeah, how do you defend a criminal case? First thing you ask yourself is, if the allegations are true, is it a crime? Well, if the allegations in this case are that he took a gun, shot a man in the back, it doesn't matter why he did it. That's a crime. That's not justified. And it's not good and it's not It's not praiseworthy. You may think that the executive had it coming. You may think there's a healthcare crisis in the United States. You can think any number of things, but the law doesn't permit us to take lives without consequences. And I think as a technical matter, the proof is probably sufficient to convict him five times over. The challenge is to see if you can beat the proof. You know, I have three kids. And six grandkids, by the way. But none of my children became lawyers. And I like to think it's because I was too honest with them at dinner. You know, I recall one year winning a case for somebody who tried to cut somebody's face off. And, you know, my wife sees me come in the door in the evening. How was your day? Oh, it was all right. Weren't you on trial? Oh, yeah. How'd it go? I won. Oh, that's great. And she looks at the kid with pride, the kids with pride. And my oldest says, what was the case about? Well, you know, and I tell them and their face fell, you know, but for me, there's nothing better, nothing more satisfying than winning a case when they got your guy and you find a way to thwart them.
Right. Right. I really can imagine.
It's a thrill.
There is a world of opportunity out there beyond the typical 9-to-5 where purpose and grit and the American spirit come together in the Peace Corps. It's been called the toughest job you'll ever love. Tough because it asks so much of you. And the love part is knowing your hard work can transform lives and build bridges across cultures. After 65 years, the Peace Corps is still the toughest job you'll ever love. Explore opportunities in more than 60 countries and apply at peacecorps.gov/serve. That's peacecorps.gov/serve. Hey everyone, I just wanted to take a quick moment to chat about something that's really been on my mind lately, my health journey. As a busy mom and businesswoman, it can feel overwhelming to prioritize my well-being, right? But ever since I found Holistic Goddess, it's like I've discovered a whole new way to think about health. They've vetted everything in their marketplace, so I know I'm getting quality products that actually really work. It's like having a friend who's done all the legwork for you. That's exactly what Holistic Goddess feels like to me, a friend sharing their real experiences and recommendations, and that's who I want to be for you, sharing things that have helped and worked for me personally. Please give Holistic Goddess a try to be your marketplace for trusted brands. Go to holisticgoddess.com. If you find something you like, use code UNDERSTOOD for 15% off. Let's talk about one of your most famous cases, Alec Jones and Sandy Hook. So, I think that people have a very hard time with this guy. Not everyone, but most people, and because of what happened in Sandy Hook. So when he came to you and he asked you, or, you know, I know a lot of the stuff you can't talk about, but can you talk about that case a little bit for our listeners that don't know much about it? Can you talk about what your defense was right off the bat and how it worked out?
So Alex Jones, as many people know, is perhaps the world's best known conspiracy theorist. And his detractors call him a hate monger. Those who love him say he has insight into things that other people don't see. He broadcasts daily from a platform that he calls InfoWars, which is owned by a company that he is the sole proprietor of called Free Speech Systems. The Sandy Hook school shootings took place on December 14th, 2012. And I remember that day because I was waiting for a verdict in another murder case across the state thinking, this isn't good. This is going to, if this gets to the jurors, they're going to convict my guy just out of sympathy for the kids. Well, Alex had an unusual take on Sandy Hook. He believes firmly in the Second Amendment right to bear arms. He's concerned that the government's trying to take the people's liberties. And he knew, to his mind, that this shooting was going to be used as a way to enforce gun control legislation, to restrict Second Amendment rights. So he started calling it a hoax and a conspiracy and looking for ways not to believe what we in Connecticut knew was obvious. I had a friend lose a stepdaughter, you know, in the shooting. So, and he denied that it took place. Many years passed, 6-8 years passed, and then the Sandy Hook families, some of them, a minority of the families, surviving families, all got together with a very prominent personal injury firm to sue Alex for defamation. The case was lingering for a while, and he couldn't get the lawyer he wanted, Mark Randazza from Massachusetts, into the case. So I was asked to serve as local counsel for another guy. In other words, to sponsor somebody for admission in Connecticut. And I did, but that fellow didn't work out. So I ended up holding the bag, as it were. I ended up as Alex's lawyer, and still am, for it'll be 5 years in March. And it was probably the wildest ride of my life in terms of the law. Alex is the same guy off the air as he is on the air. And he runs at a high rate of speed and everything's related to everything else. And he's a touch on the paranoid side. And so I was tested in ways. My loyalty was tested. People in his camp thought I was an undercover CIA agent for a while. I was surveilled. You know, I mean, it was a unique experience as the law goes. In the end, however, I think a greater hoax was perpetrated on the American public. And that is that somehow that he was proved to have caused $1.5 billion worth of damage to these families. Mm-hmm. He ended up being defaulted, losing the right to defend on the merits because he wasn't unable to provide all the information to the plaintiffs that they wanted. So a judge gave him a disciplinary default. And when we went to the trial, which was a hearing in damages, the jury was told not that he was defaulted because he had not complied fully with discovery, but they were told that it had been determined that he was responsible for all that befell the Sandy Hook families. There was no judicial determination of that effect. Mm. And the other side never even put on medical records. They put on very little evidence. They just let the families talk about how much they missed their children, how much what Alex said hurt them. And they were given damages awards individually ranging from $90 million to $120 million. That's a mockery of justice.
Right. Well, I understand. But I think, wasn't it? I mean, I'm assuming it was not cut and dry. But if he cannot provide the discovery that it was a hoax, you would think that, I mean, was that what they were looking for, that he couldn't provide?
No, they believed that he and his lieutenants got together and used Google Analytics to determine what sort of stories sold. And when they got a hot button, when they got a lot of clicks, they'd repeat it for the sake of more clicks. Because what supports free speech systems in Alex Jones was the sale of nutraceuticals and other items. So they wanted to drive, the theory was, clicks to their site so they could sell products.
So I was just, for the layperson that's listening to this. So your defense was not, he's correct, this was a hoax, this didn't happen. It was more that whatever he was saying was opinion and it was protected under the First Amendment.
That's right.
Right.
That's right.
Okay. Right. So I think because a lot of people stop and don't even listen to the rest because they're like, well, wait, it happened. How could he say it didn't happen? He should pay, you know, more money that he even has to bankrupt him because of what he made those people feel. And the fact that he put out that fake news to some people that do believe that stuff. And like you said, you know, someone who lost a child in that. I mean, wasn't that hard? I mean, does he think that it didn't happen?
No, I don't know what he thinks. Ultimately, I've spent hours with the guy, months probably now at this point, because I used to go down to Texas a week at a time just to get a little bit of time with him. He has said he believes it happens. I think what he got blinded by was the secondary gain that the victims got. I mean, for example, here's a book. Robbie Parker was one of the parents who lost a family member. I guess you can't see it, but it's called The Father's Fight, Taking on Alex Jones and Reclaiming the Truth About Sandy Hook. I mean, it's an unusual enterprise to build your identity around the death of a child. And I think Alex feared that the secondary gain that these folks would seek would be used and weaponized for political purposes. And it was.
Right. Another one I want to ask you about.
Yeah, right, she says. Let's go on to a different topic so I don't throw something at the screen.
It's interesting to hear your perspective. I want to ask you actually a question about what you mentioned earlier. Do you believe that clients like yours should take the stand, especially if they have something about them that people are enthralled by, like Luigi, you know, who people are somewhat in love with, some people. So you feel like he could really resonate and get some empathy with people. What are your thoughts on taking the stand?
One of the most amazing cases I ever had was a case that is known in this part of the country as the tennis shoe murder case. It involved a young man named John Gibbs. And young guys like tennis shoes for some reason. You know, they're a big deal. This is about 8-9 years ago, and Nike had come out with a new shoe. And he put one on Facebook saying, you want to buy the shoe? You know, here I am. So somebody contacted, agreed to meet him one Father's Day night in an urban area. And when John went, he came with his uncle. His uncle was a convicted felon. They got in the pickup truck and they drove to the site. And the young man had a gun, or gestured toward that he had a gun, ran off with John's shoes, and a shot rang out. And then John was looking for the guy, couldn't find him. Mm-hmm. Next day, a SWAT team wakes John up, and it wasn't for coffee and Dunkin' Donuts. They wanted to question him about a murder. So they take him to the police station. Were you in the area of such and, you know, where the shoe sales to take place? Yes. What happened? Well, you know, this guy ran off with my shoes, and I had a gun in my car. I have a registration for it. I fired a warning shot into the air. How is he? Oh, he's okay, the cop said. You know, and they don't let him know that he's dead. So this interview goes on for about 2 hours, and then John signs a confession, and the cop says, we're charging you with murder. And John's like, what? Nobody told me the guy got hit, right? So he calls me, and he tells me that, in fact, his uncle was in the car. He lied to the police about that. His uncle was in the car. His uncle fired the shot, but he didn't want to narc his uncle out or rat his uncle out because his uncle was a felon. He'd go to jail for felon in possession of a firearm. So he lied. So our defense was that John Gibbs lied under oath to protect an uncle who was more of a father to him than his own father. And I put John Gibbs on the stand to take the same oath that he was going to say he lied to before and tell the jury why he lied. And the jury acquitted him of every form of homicide. So I had to put him on to win that case. And it was hugely risky. But in the face of a conviction, or excuse me, in the face of a confession, he was going down if we didn't. Right. So, you know, it's always a tough call to put a client on the stand. And as a matter of law, that's something the client decides. The lawyer merely advises. If right. the client says, look, I want to testify, and you say, it's a horrible idea, and they're going on. If you beg the client to testify and they say, I can't, that's just the way it is. I think that jurors do not really follow legal instructions. They assume that a person's there and they want to know what they did rather than what did the state accuse and can the state prove it? And so I think jurors want to hear from the accused. And, you know, trial is just excruciating because when you win, when I win, I'm unbearable. Oh, look what I did. When I lose, I'm inconsolable. Oh, my God, look what I did. And so you do it over and over again. It's like life, right? You know, what's that saying? What's the definition of insanity? You do the same thing over and over again and expect a different result. Right. So, you know, you put your heart on the line and some days it's vindicated. Some days it's broken and shattered in 1,000 pieces. You come back to the office, you look through your files and say, well, next month I'm trying this. In every case that I've lost, I wish the client had testified if he did. If he did, if he didn't. If he did, I wish he hadn't. In every case that I win, if he's there, I'm glad he did. So I there's no rhyme or reason to it. But I do think that juries want to hear from the accused. And unless your defense is I wasn't there, like a really difficult case. One of the most difficult cases you can have is an old child sex abuse case where 30 years after the allegation, you're accused suddenly and you're facing forever behind bars. What do you do with that? Do you know where you were 30 years ago last night? And what's your alibi going to be for that night if you're suddenly accused of doing something? Of course you can't. You can't remember that.
Right. Those are so hard. I don't know what I did last week. So, you know. I know those are very hard, but I think people do want to hear. I'm curious, do you keep in touch with your clients who are sent to prison for life?
Some, yeah. So one guy was, I don't want to mention his name, but he was an assassin for the Hell's Angels. And I didn't handle his trial, but I handled some post-conviction work for him and got to know him. And he's covered head to toe. Well, not head to toe. He's got more tattoos than just about anybody that I know. And he's doing, you know, 60 years. He's been behind bars now for 20, 25 years. Every couple of years, I'll pop in and say hello. And we were talking the other day and I said, you know, what is it, Joe? What is it about you that just fills me with calmness? You know, I have everything that that you could want as a professional. But when I come to see you, I feel like I'm lacking something. And I find you to be such a peaceful person. And he said, look, they can lock away my body, but they can't touch my soul. I'm more free than anyone I know. And so I enjoy that about him.
Wow.
I saw a client the other day who was convicted of murder 22 years ago. I still believe he's innocent. And we talked about what happened and some of the decisions he'd made in the trial. Feel horrible for him. If I could set him free in a heartbeat, I would. I'm happy not to see again. I mean, they just were miserable human beings when I met them, and they were even more miserable if they got convicted.
Right. Do you think after working with so many of these people, the fear is more death penalty or life in prison?
I represented Michael Ross briefly in his effort to get books from publishers, and when he was on death row, and he chose to give up the fight for death, reasoning that it was better to die than to be held forever. Mm-hmm. I think that most of the longtime prisoners that I've gotten to know have found a life for themselves behind bars. Yeah, they'd rather be free, but the human spirit is inconquerable, and they find a way to subside and find a way to exist. And there's a pecking order in a whole social world. You know, years ago, I called the attorney general's office in Connecticut. I said, can I volunteer for a 60-day sentence? And they said, what? I said, well, you know, I'm always advising people to take pleas and go to prison rather than this. I've never tasted the product. And I've accused judges who sentenced men to prison. If you ever spent a night there, do you know what you're doing to this man or this woman and their family? I think all judges should be required to spend 2-3 weeks in jail so they know what they're selling.
Oh, my God. Can you imagine? God.
No. But it'd be fun. It's a fun thought
experiment.
It would
be fun. I've been to Alcatraz, and I always thought, ooh, this could be fun if they, you know, just locked the doors and you had to stay and see what that was like. But you know, I watch a lot of those things on ID or whatever, what talks about life in prison. And I would never spit a piece of gum on the sidewalk because I'm so nervous of being in jail.
I represented a woman in Connecticut who got sentenced to. She was extradited back to Connecticut from Ireland on the condition that Connecticut wouldn't seek the death penalty, and she was convicted. And I came in to try to get her a new trial, and it failed. And watching her has been horrible because I'm watching her spirit evaporate. Mm. You know, there was a time as her biological clock began to tick loudly that she would worry quite a bit about having a baby. And I'd say, don't get any ideas with me. And then it became spending time with her parents who are getting older. And now it's, will I ever get out while I'm alive? And, you know, the answer to all three of those questions was no, no, no. And it's just heartbreaking. The cruelty of it to me is overwhelming.
Right. And how do you feel about some of these guys that maybe have gotten off, or women that you've had released back into the streets that you know are dangerous people, but you won the case?
Yeah. That's funny. That story I told about the dinner, you know, the guy wrote me. So this guy gets, you know, he's free, and a year later he killed somebody. Yeah, I don't feel good about it. Mm. I don't feel I'm responsible for the death. I think the state had a case to prove and it failed. Right. I think I won. No one gets out of here alive, Rachel. Life is life. It, no matter how blessed anyone may be in terms of talent, fortune, fame, whatever, we all know own nature of death, and there are dark thoughts that need to be thought in the middle of the night, and criminal defense makes you dwell with them. And so sometimes, you know, Nietzsche has this wonderful line, you know, beware lest you stare into the abyss stares into you. And I have been phenomenally depressed from time to time in the course of my career and at wit's end. And, you know, it's just driven me to my knees in the sense that I need the grace of a loving God to account for all that I've done. And I need the mercy of a forgiving God to atone for all the wrongs and harms that I've done to people. I don't have any doubt that I've been an instrument of chaos in some people's lives.
What is the most difficult ethical dilemma you faced as a defense attorney? And how did you resolve it while maintaining your commitment to your client or to yourself?
The case involved Daniel Webb, and I've had to testify about this in open court, so I'm not breaking a privilege. Mr. Webb was facing the death penalty for the rape and murder of Diane Gallenbach in the mid-1990s, maybe the early 90s, I don't remember now, and he was convicted. And I was taking his appeal, and it was a very complicated appeal, 300 pages of briefs and whatnot. And in the course of his appeal, one of my paralegals, office assistants, came to me and said, we have a request from him to send mail to a third party. Can we do it? I said, sure. I mean, my view was the state's trying to kill the guy, right? You know, so, I mean, the least we can do is give him a stamp. A month later, she walked in and she was a Puerto Rican woman, but she was whiter than I was that day. She was like, you won't believe what happened. We got another letter from him and a request that we send it on. And I opened it and it's detailed instructions to some guys to try to shoot his way out of the Supermax one day when he's out in the yard for recreation. So I read through the plans and they were pretty calm, pretty good. It probably wouldn't have worked, but some people would have got killed trying. Mm-hmm. So, you know, on the one hand, I'm rooting for him to be freed. I'm a passionate anti-death penalty opponent. I'm passionately anti-death penalty. Get rid of that double negative. And I want him to succeed. But on the other hand, I can't stand by while he plans to harm and maybe kill third parties. Mm-hmm. So I consulted a number of lawyers I respected for ethical decisions, opinions on what I should do. Some people said destroy the letter. Some people said get it out of state so it can't be subpoenaed. Some people said you need to turn it over to authorities. But I thought about what to do, and I decided that out of my duty of fairness to third parties, I couldn't stand by when there was a credible threat that a third party would be murdered. So I called the commissioner of corrections lawyer and had the commissioner and the lawyer come into my office one Sunday afternoon, and I gave them the letter. And they asked me a question about it. I said, I'm not going to answer those questions. So the next thing you know, I'm summoned into court, and I've learned that doing that, transshipping mail for an inmate, is a federal offense. So I'm potentially going to incriminate myself if I say anything. So I'm called to the witness stand in open court and ask questions. And I took the fifth to every question. And I had to stop representing this client at this point because we had a conflict. So that was probably the hardest decision I ever had to make, because I genuinely came to like things about him, not what he did, obviously. But I came to, and I extended myself to fight for him. And now I was having to give up that fight, and it hurt.
Right. Wow. I want to ask you about media and high profile cases. How do you think media coverage influences the trajectory of high profile cases, and what strategies do you use to protect your clients from potential bias?
Well, it depends on the client. So the first time I had a really high profile case, I think at least in New York City, was the Manhattan Madam case, or the soccer mom Madam, Anna Christina. And boy, I mean, nothing sells like sex. And so, you know, I mean, I always say that we are a sexophrenic nation. You know, we want to be prudes about it when it doesn't suit our interests, but we sell everything with it, right? You know, from toothpaste to cars. And so here she was, the woman who was the madam for people with twisted tastes. For $40,000, you could be abducted by some dominatrix, driven around in a limousine, and dumped off in Central Park when you've had whatever it is you paid for. And so it was a fun case. And yet the message in that case was that this, you know, that she had it, she was presumed innocent, and we wanted a fair trial. And so that was hard. But we said as little as possible there, in part because I was a visiting lawyer in New York at the time, and the Manhattan District Attorney's Office was trying to get me off the case. So I had to mind my P's and Q's. Another case was the Fotis Doulos case, which I can't talk about because I've been sued over it. But that was a case where we had a lot to say. And we ended up with a lot of litigation about what was said. The rules of professional conduct prohibit a lawyer from making out-of-court statements that could adversely affect a jury trial. What does that mean? If you make a statement 2 years before trial, nobody's going to remember. If during trial you get on the steps of the courthouse and say that witness was a liar, you're going to lose your law license. So somewhere between those two extremes, you have freedom to rebut the bad news about your client with your own information, and then a client whose interest you have to consult. Some people don't want publicity. Some people want a lot. So you know, it's like everything else. It's a multifactorial analysis.
Right. Something that was high profile, let's talk about the Proud Boys. It's January 6th. We're a few years out now from what happened. I know that you're still working on appeal with some of them. Can you talk about what happened originally? Like, lead us through what happened with them.
So the Proud Boys, you know, I represented and still represent Joe Biggs. I represented him in a trial in Washington, D.C. that took about 5.5 months. And it was the government's theory that the Proud Boys were part of a broader plan to use violence to stop the election of Joe Biden. And so the government charged seditious conspiracy, something that's almost never been used in American law. And all seditious conspiracy meant in that case was they agreed to use violence to oppose the authority of the United States government, in this case by storming the Capitol on January 6th to prevent the counting of electoral votes. Mm-hmm. At trial, at opening statements, the government said they were going to show that there was a plan. But they never did prove that there was a plan. What they proved is that a lot of emotional people went to the mall, the Capitol Mall on January 6th, and they reacted, and then things became violent. So at closing argument, the prosecution argued that this could have been what's called an implicit conspiracy formed at the moment the barricades were burst. In other words, that these people knew one another's mind, agreed through their conduct to act. And that just struck me as a miscarriage of justice, because what it said was, if you use inflammatory speech and you go to an event and violence occurs, they're going to use that inflammatory speech as circumstantial evidence of your criminal intent. And thus, dissent is always at risk in the United States of being criminalized. You hear people talk about lawfare. I think that's what they're talking about. So even though the verdict was returned, I think in May, this is 2025, in May of 2023, our briefs still haven't been submitted to the appellate court. It's about 130,000 page trial transcript. It's going to take a little while to get through. But in the meantime, the briefs are due in May. Mm. In the meantime, we're seeking pardons from Donald Trump, and we're reasonably optimistic that we'll get them as soon as January 21st.
Oh, wow. Okay. What else are you, I know we talked about this a little off air, but tell people what else you're working on right now that you're excited about.
You know, I'm just trying to, I had a rough 5 years between Alex Jones, the Doulos case, and the Proud Boys. That's about all I did.
Those are some tough ones. Yeah.
Yeah. And none of the cases worked out well for me, which means I get slaughtered on social media. Fortunately, my phone still rings off the hook, and I've tried half a dozen cases since. And I'm just trying to get reacquainted with the humdrum aspects of the law, what I call ordinary murder, ordinary robbery, ordinary chaos. And so I'm getting ready for a murder trial right now.
Well, hold on. I want to ask you, when you say it hasn't gone well for you. I mean, a lot of these people were not, you know, it was a very uphill battle. So I think going well for you, would you have thought that meant they get off, or it just, they were given a harsher sentence than you thought and you're still working on it? What does that mean for you?
There's a saying among criminal defense lawyers, you're only as good as your last verdict, and the public doesn't want to know the reasons or what's behind it. If you lost, you lost. And, you know, it's not an athletic event. If it was an athletic event, I'm cocky enough to say I'd win every time because I think I'm that good and I know the code of evidence that well. And, you know, I'll walk in a room with four lawyers on the other side and I'll say, that's all you got. I like my odds. I'm cocky that way. But I and I'm competitive. I don't like losing, period.
But when you say win, does that mean getting them off completely? I mean, some of these people, you know, that was not ever an option, I would think.
By the time, if you don't believe, when you walk into a courtroom, if you don't believe you can win, you should turn the file over to someone else. Your job is to find a way to win. And, you know, I used to hang out with Jerry Spence a lot years ago. I taught at his trial lawyer's college out in Wyoming. And he likes to say he never lost a criminal case. You know, I don't know what that means. And by the way, if he happens to see this, he turns 96 today. So happy birthday,
Jerry. Oh my
gosh. Yeah, 96. Think about that. But
does he still wear those jackets with the fringes?
He probably still has him. I haven't seen him in a couple of years. He spends most of his time in Santa Barbara now, and he's a very good painter. And so I went out to sit with him one afternoon. Actually, I was representing him and members of the board of his trial lawyers college in a legal dispute. And I thought, man, what a wonderful painter he is. Great storyteller, good writer, fantastic lawyer. But, you know, it just wasn't fun being in the news on the losing side of a case with people who are unpopular. There are people who make a avocation out of breaking my stones, you know, and I'd much rather have nice things said of me than not. But given the choices I've made, you take what you get.
Right. Well, it's interesting because for you, I think people just look at you and I'm assuming are angry with you or make statements because you're representing people that so many people have a hard time believing, wishing they had representation at all. So I think that just comes on you, but it doesn't show whether or not, nobody's really talking about whether or not you're a good lawyer or not. Even if you got them off, people would say, oh my God, what a scumbag.
No, I know. It's just, it's been, I mean, I'm trying to be real with you, and it just does hurt. Yeah. You know, I mean, I'm not going to lie and say, it's all great. I'm that tough a guy. I'm not. I have a new office manager, and, she'd heard a little bit about me before she came here. And after she'd been here for about a month, she says, "Can I talk to you?" I said, "Well, you are." And she says, "You're not at all what I thought you'd be." And I said, "Well, what does that mean?" "I thought you'd be this really nasty, loud prick. You know, you're soft spoken and you're a nice guy." And I'm like, thank you. Call my wife, let her know. You know, my wife was very disappointed in some of the choices of clients that I had in the last few years. And that was difficult.
Right. I can imagine. But yes, you come off as being empathetic and have more to you than, just a tough external layer. I want to ask you about the Brian Koberger case, the Idaho murders. What are your thoughts on the defense challenges in cases like his where DNA evidence and public fascination seemed to dominate the narrative for him?
It's two separate questions. The public fascination thing is an interesting question. I've had many cases where there was enormous public fascination with what happened. For example, a man once threw his 7-month-old child off the biggest bridge in the state and then jumped in after him. The child didn't survive. He did. So he was accused with murder. And I thought it's going to be impossible to pick a jury in this case because everybody was talking about it. But what you find when you walk into a court is, notwithstanding the public fascination, most people have their own dramas. You know, I don't know you. This is the first time we met. I'm guessing you have a life beyond misunderstood. And sometimes it's going well and sometimes it's not. And sometimes your heart is broken and you're lonely and you wish you had somebody to talk to. And that's the world that all of us live in. We're not reading the newspaper saying, "Oh, that's the guy." And so what I have found is often people haven't even heard of the cases. And those who have often reach negative conclusions. You get them off the jury. I've sat with many a person who about whom horrible things were written in the paper. And I said, "Look, here's the good news. If there are 100 people out here, 90 of them don't know who we are, and they don't care less who you are. Of the 10 that remain, 6 of them think you're a scumbag, and now they know why. 2 of them maybe like you, and they don't believe the allegations. And the other 2 people, they're unsure, and that's who we're fighting for here." So I think they just have to ignore the public outcry and prepare their jury selection, their voir dire, to screen those people out. As to DNA evidence, you know, I love DNA evidence. The science is really fascinating, and it's difficult. But DNA experts are so used to being given a free pass that if you really challenge them, you'd be surprised at what you can get. So in Connecticut, for example, it used to be that I don't have a report on my desk here, but it used to be that DNA was reported. DNA, what is DNA? It's the stuff of life, right? We've got these 3 billion proteins, you know, attached to one another, or, you know, base pairs. And the state will locate about 23 of them. And of all those 3 billion pairs, 99% of ours are identical to apes. So the trick is locating those few that distinguish us, not just from the apes, but from one another. And then comparing knowns versus unknowns. Well, did you know that there's a largely subjective element in interpretation of DNA evidence? They compare peaks of proteins at certain points. And sometimes the peaks are what are known as artifacts. That's when you don't get a match. Sometimes they're a match, and that's when they get the guy they want. And so, you know, if you spend your time and you do your homework, you're going to have a lot of fun with DNA evidence. And the fact that his DNA may have been on an item means that he was there. It doesn't mean that he did it. Now, how are you going to account that he was there? Is it a false positive? I mean, I don't know enough about the evidence in that case, but I know that it's a lot of work in that.
Right. Okay. Let's see. In your opinion, what's the most significant legal case or trend of 2025 going to be? Like, what are you looking at?
In 2020, it was simple. It was the emergence of the public health state in response to COVID. And I got involved in litigation around the country testing emergency orders. Right now, I think it's the challenge of living in an algorithmic universe and AI. So much of of our world, the boundaries of our social world, are determined by hidden formula, as it were, or algorithms that we don't know about or don't know much about. And so I think that as the state acquires more information, defending liberty or zones of significance for people becomes paramount. Let me give you a perfect example. A couple of years ago, I reread the dystopian classics, Aldous Huxley's 1984, George Orwell's not well, Brave New World, George Orwell's 1984, Fahrenheit 451 by Bradbury, Margaret Atwood's The Handmaid's Tale, and others. And I was wondering, what makes these tales so popular? And here's what it was. In each case, society had evolved to the point where if you followed the rules, you could have a good life. You'd be secure. You wouldn't have to worry about your future. In each case, the protagonist said, that good life isn't good enough for me. What they wanted was a sense of individual significance, the ability to chart their own course. I think that as we move into a world that is dominated more and more by big data, we're willing to sacrifice more of our individual liberty. And we're going to come to a breaking point or a tipping point where people would rather be miserable and free or miserable and making their own decisions than have happiness forced down their throat. And so that's what I view the larger background of more interesting cases to be. What's the example? Electronic searches is a way of determining crimes, or the minority report. You know, can you get involved with a predictive algorithm that says, oh, yes, misunderstood. There's a 96% likelihood that she'll rob a bank within the next 3 years. So let's lock her up now. Lock her up now. We know that to be true. And even if it is true, should you be locked up before you commit the crime? You know, so these are things that I worry about in the middle of the night.
Very interesting. I had Mark Garagos on, and I asked him who his most misunderstood client was, and he said Michael Jackson, which I found fascinating. Who would yours be?
And, you know, no individual comes to mind. I think, you know, I've spent a lot of time representing sex offenders, and I'm not sure we understand what's going on in their world in general. And I think there are libidinal errors that shouldn't result in a lifetime of ostracization. And so I wish we had a better way of determining who is a dangerous sex offender from somebody who just made a mistake. I mean, when I was 15, I may have known a woman who was 19 who introduced me to things that 15-year-olds shouldn't be introduced to as a matter of law. You'll never convince me she was a criminal. I thought she was the fourth person of the Trinity. And so yet, if she had been caught, she would have been a felon, right? Mm-hmm. So I would say sex offenders are, in general, widely misunderstood.
Okay, looking back on your career, which case do you think had the most impact on your legacy as a defense attorney? And what do you think people learn from your approach?
You know, I fight every case the same way. Not maybe 25 years ago, the guy who's become my best friend, I had lunch with him, and I was doing a couple murders in Middletown. And I wasn't killing anybody. I was defending people accused of murder. I did two in a row, and it took about 6.5 months to get those done. And about 5 months into the 5 months into the second the series of trials, I said to him, "Man, these cases are killing me. They just won't stop. They won't end." And he looked at me and says, "Well, what do you think they have in common?" I said, "I don't know." He said, "You." And so if I had a legacy, I would want it to be known as a tireless fighter who will do whatever the law permits to defend a client. I mean, one of the cases I'm most proud of was a woman in Connecticut who had a 4th of July party. She left the party, had a couple drinks, and on the way home got in a head-on collision. She was seriously injured. Two of her children were killed in the crash, and a third survived. She was accused of drunken driving and manslaughter and risk of injury to a child. We put the case to trial. My view was, even if she had done all those things, she had a child to raise, and no punishment could be worse than being responsible for your own child's death. Well, we won that trial, and she walked away from it. And I got a nice note from one of the jurors years later. You know, you were relentless, you were dogged, and you left no stone unturned. And years later, I ran into the state toxicologist in an airport. He says, "You know, I've never forgotten your cross-examination of me." And I said, "Good, that's the way it should be."
Oh, my gosh. I was just thinking about something. In 2024, one of the biggest trials was the Karen Reed trial. And I was about to ask you if you thought she was guilty or innocent, and if you agreed with, you know, what happened there at the end. But I stopped myself because I wonder, is that a question that should even be asked of you if you think that they're guilty or innocent? Or is it more like, do you think that justice was served and they proved their case or didn't prove it well enough? Like, does it matter if you think someone is guilty?
One of the things that's truly unfortunate in the criminal justice system is we've imported moral terminology into evaluating what goes on in the court. I think of guilt as a moral concept. Was Jimmy Carter adulterous? No. But did he lust after women in his heart? Yes. Does that make him guilty of that? Well, I suppose it does. But who cares, ultimately, between him, his wife, him, God, you know, his parishioners? In the end, whether the state can prove its case is what a jury is what a jury is there to decide. Whether they did the crime or not, you know, I'll be honest with you, Rachel, in the overwhelming majority of cases that I've been involved in, I don't really know what happened. You know, I know that there's reasons to go forward with the case and there may be enough to convict my client. My job is to create reasonable doubt. In some cases, they're overwhelmingly it's overwhelmingly easy for the state. In some cases, it's not possible. I'm working up a murder case right now, a so-called cold case of a shooting that took place in 2008, looking through warrants that contain things in there that just can't possibly be true. I mean, even they're internally inconsistent. But I've never asked my client, did you shoot the guy? Because I don't particularly care one way or another. I'm not a moralist.
Right. Okay. You are a fascinating guy. We're out of time, but if people want to follow your story, follow your cases, know more about you, how can they learn about you?
I think I have a website. I mean, I know I do. And your producer told me that he found it. So there it is.
Normpattis.com if you don't know what it is.
Yeah. And I used to have a podcast of my own. I used to write, I've spent 20, 25 years writing newspaper columns. But I've decided to take a year off right now and ask myself some deeper questions. You know, I'll turn 70 this year and nobody gets out of here alive. And, you know, what's the point of it all? And so I'm spending a lot of time this year just reflecting. So I think, you know, just Google Norm Pattis. Don't believe half of what you hear. If it's good, think it might be true. If it's bad, it can't be true.
All right. Well, good luck with all the things you have going on. I appreciated meeting you. I appreciate how open and honest you are. And I agree with the person who is now working with you. I think that you are much different than what people think. And I love how you opened this whole conversation saying that you were one of the misunderstood when you were younger. And that's why you identify with the people that you represent. So
no question about it. I am saved by grace and I'm a lucky man. And what I mean by that is just small kindnesses of strangers. But for the kindness of strangers, I don't know what I would have become.
Right. I appreciate you.
Thank you. Be well.
Thank you so much for listening to Misunderstood. I'm your host, Rachel Yucatel. Please be sure to subscribe to the show and give us a 5-star rating and review. You can support the show by joining our Patreon at patreon.com/misunderstood with Rachel Yucatel. Do you have ideas for the show or want to reach out? Email us at info@misunderstoodpodcast@gmail.com. That's spelled MISS understood. Thank you so much, and I'll see you next time.